finishing a PhD, which I'm having in the next sort of month, and this data depends on that. I also do some teaching at Cardiff. I also do some access teaching at Newport University and some teaching at Learn. So I've got a real interest in returning students, and I return to higher education myself as a tutor. And I'd also like to say thank you to the chair and thank you to Faith for inviting me. And I must also thank Escalade, because I applied for the open competition and they funded me to come to this conference. Okay, so I'm going to give you a bit of background on the presentation for the day. I'm going to tell you about my research, give you a brief overview of that. And then I'm just going to introduce two mature students, both mothers, from my research and tell you about their journey into higher education and also why they eventually gave up higher education. I'm working in Wales, so we have not the AIM Higher programme, but there are similar initiatives. And AIM Higher is really all about aspiration and raising aspirations of non-traditional students and getting them to think about higher education as a route for them. So, that's all very good, and evaluations of the programme, such as the Northern Dunworth recent work, have shown this to have been successful. So students who should never consider HE are now looking at HE for an option for them. So in that way, it's been very successful. But entrance itself doesn't expel all the financial and cultural and social and psychological barriers. So it's okay aiming higher. We've really got to think about what happens when you get there. And the concept of aiming high can also be seen as problematic because, again, like we were talking about yesterday, this individualist discourse places a lot of responsibility on the individual. So if all you follow is aim high, if it's as simple as that, it gives the impression that when you get there, it's this even playing field. You've aimed higher, you just need to think about it, and now you'll be able to get your degree. Obviously, we all know it's not as simple as that, and a lot of work's been done. The What Works Student and Retention Programme, again, has had some success. And instead of just expecting students to aim higher, this has looked at the way that the institution needs to change. It's not just about non-traditional students to change to fit in with traditional universities, but how universities can change to help things be easier for these students. But like the first paper, I really believe you've got to ask students about their experience. If you're going to make these changes, they need to be informed as opposed to ignorant. There's no point implementing changes without having a detailed consultation with the people that you're making the changes for. So, I worked in communities first areas, and in Wales these are areas, the sort of top 100 marginalised areas in Wales. So, there's all the usual poverty yardsticks like high unemployment, high take of school, free meals. And Morrison and Wilkinson argue that there's been huge polarisation of place in Wales. And they call it the loss angelisation of the socio-economic terrain to draw parallels with the inequalities in American cities. And I've worked in these marginalised areas, and the area that I worked specifically in, on the Welsh Index of Multiple Deprivation, scores highest in education skills and training. So in that area particularly, And this absence, this really high absence of education, can make it very difficult for those residents who do decide to go, because then they're then forced to live in this interface between two discursively different worlds. And I'll pick it up on that point later. Quickly just about the data production, so I use three methods of visual data production. I ask people to take photographs of their local area. I ask them to make maps of what they do inside and outside the home. I ask them to make collages about their everyday lives. And then I also did a second stage of analysis and data collection when I asked the mothers, they were all mothers and daughters, so all the participants were mother and daughter dyads. So I asked mothers to think about when they were their daughter's age and what they wanted to be and what they didn't want to be. And I asked daughters to do the same. And then we had conversations around these stories that they wrote. And the position of the research, I should just flick back to quickly. It was an area that I'd lived in myself. I had a lot of similarities with the mothers. And that's why I use visual data. Because if I'd gone on my own and done an interview, we would have sat down and they would have said, oh, well, the problem with this area is, or the problem with this, and I said, oh, I know all about that, because I used to live here. And they wouldn't have been able to tell me anything, they thought, because I'm guarding with all my own preconceptions. So I use the visuals to sort of make the familiar strange, so I could step back a little bit. When I got it back, I discussed all the data, all the stories, all the visuals, but I didn't go off and take it and say, oh, this means this, because they use a shade of blue. We did interviews around everything. And then I used psychosocial analysis approaches of analysis. So three broad research questions. One about the place, about the stigma of place and how that impacts on education and employment. One about social reproduction. Why do working class girls get working class jobs? What's passed on mother to daughter? Is it as simple as that? And also, how does gender impact? Because we're never just of a particular class, we're always a particular class, and ethnicity and gender. So, Caroline, I'm going to tell you about first, her academic history. She left school at 15, no O-levels, worked in the three C's, in the catering, and the cleaning and the caring industry. Describes her own employment in her interview as jobs that are a load of shit. She wanted to go to university, she wanted to get some qualifications because she wanted upward social mobility for her family. But when she started this journey, she found that it conflicted. It conflicted with her gender and her class and her identity. And it threatened her idea of legitimate motherhood. So, when I ask people to take photos of their everyday lives, there's a lot of irons and hoovers in a lot of the mothers' photographs. Not many of the daughters' photographs, but in many of the mothers' photographs. And this one, she says, you know, it's not too bad with these, and she's serious, she's not joking, it's not too bad with these irons they've got now. I'm not there all day like I used to be just half a day. So it's an improvement for the old irons. And we talk a lot about cleaning and ironing and who does what and who should be doing what and if there are any conflicts. And Caroline sees the cleanliness of the home very much linked with her identity and having a respectable working class femininity. And if you look at the sort of history of cleanliness in the working classes, you'll see that dirt assumes a heightened importance when the metaphors for your class linked with muck and filth and dirt and waste products. So it becomes very important to have a clean house. It becomes very important for identity. It's also argued by Ireland, particularly in Wales, because Wales is a colonised country, that the working class identity and the idea of cleanliness is intensified for women in Wales. And you've got this ideology of this Welsh man. that still holds a lot of residents. So she heavily invests her identity in its domestic sphere. But the ideal notion of this new motherhood isn't just about the domestic sphere. So instead of just doing that, you're supposed to be able to do everything. So now you're supposed to be able to hold down a full-time job. You're supposed to be able to keep this very clean house. You're supposed to be able to fulfill your children's emotional needs and bring money in. Okay. And this is what one of her, she's got three children. And one of the children says this. It's not a spelling mistake because he's quite young. So he says, I hate that university. I wish you never went to that university. Because she's not having as much time. She's not having as much time for the children. And again, this clashes very much with what Holloway calls the capacity to care. She hasn't got time. So Caroline's transgressing the social and moral identities that she's grown up with and the person she is. She did 2 years of part-time access and 2 years of full-time study. Okay, one year to go. But unfortunately, she couldn't do that every year. It was too much. It was too much pressure. And it wasn't the type of thing she could go to the teacher and say, oh, I've got this problem. It's not on the special circumstances list. You can't go to your personal tutor and say, I have to do that ironing. My skirt holes have to be clean. That's not going to be on the list. Okay? It's nothing that you can easily get support for. So after all this investment in education, she found herself going back. So when I spoke to her in the second stage, she was applying again for cleaning work, for catering work, having to let go of the hopes and dreams for herself, and also the hopes and dreams that she had for her older daughter. And the older daughter was going to do A-levels, the older daughter didn't end up doing A-levels. So the dream was fresh not just for the mother, but also for the daughter. Okay, Emma, similar story. Hustrid, born and bred, which is a pseudonym for my place, it's not a real place name. She says, where I am, it's just horrible, I don't think you'd like to live there. Where she lives, there's a lot of drug activity. She's at the side of two gullies, which are like walkway alleyways. And on the one alleyway, they sell heroin. On the other alleyway, they sell greens or cannabis. So she's always had, again, low-paid and qualified posts. Same as the partner she lives with. Same sort of cleaning, these types of jobs. Lots of insecurity, lots of unemployment. Again, she said, I need to do this for my children. I don't want my children to live here. I want my children to live somewhere else. So, Emma goes on to access, and she goes to college. This is a picture from her collage. She made, oh no, her this is, she's drawn this by her. But she sees this as a process of separation from her family. So, even though she's in her mid-30s, before this she always went to her mum's house every day. They're a very close-knit family. She would visit her mum every day, take the children to school, sit to the mum's house. When she's talking about the family, she's talking about the wider family. Her mothers, her brothers, extended family. And she says, you know, do you know what it means? It's weird. It's like I'm not there. I don't know. It's just weird. I'm in a totally different place to them. Okay. So, Emma says it's in a new world with this local college. But ideologically, it locates her in a totally different place than her family. And she didn't expect to feel out of place or that her family would feel out of place. It's not what she was expecting. She also goes on to talk about grief and loss. I think there was a bit of jealousy at the start of me joining college. And she's talking about jealousy from her men. Okay? The family really didn't want her to go. The extended family was very resistant to her doing something that they don't do, doing something that's not for them. And she speaks about grief and the feeling she's lost something. And despite the laughter in our talk, she laughs while she's telling me it's a very painful process of belonging to, yet distancing herself from the family. It's a process that's been documented by other people, like Fanny Walkerside and Hailey Lucy. But it's extremely painful. So, Emma then becomes a border crosser, and she's living at this interface. She's going to the college, she's trying to do something new. She's coming back to a street where no one else is in education. She's going back to her family, visiting her family who don't agree with her taking up this path. And I would argue, as Matty says, the mother's trying to fix and stabilise an identity in a particular place, in a particular family. But Emma's desire for a new life is threatening this. And this places her beyond, but also paradoxically within the family. And the psychological consequences of the spatial position in the border are very severe. Okay. It's very difficult to exist in this borderland between being one and the other. And if you look at Lucy, 2003, she refers to this as hybridity. So this irresolvable positioning of in-betweenness. And the psychological cost is an ongoing and painful grief, the feeling that she's lost something. And the cost of this symbolic death is distressing. But again, it's not something that would be viewed as a special circumstance. It's a psychological rather than physical death.
Okay, we do have some time for some questions, so who would like to start?
Just a comment really about how different the sort of data we're getting back in terms of where they live and the communities they're coming from. Because obviously the students I'm talking to have made that crossing into this new world, and motivationally they've made it, sort of emotionally they've made it.
Mm. Yeah, and there was the only person, because there were other people who did try different forms of education in my sample, and the only person that made it, and she did get a first, was one of the daughters. So I had mothers and daughters in different age groups, and some daughters were in the post-compulsory education, and she did get a place, and she did get a first, but the sort of psychological scarring of that process, and she didn't. She chose a university that she could commute to because
leaving home wasn't an option, and she kept saying about being a home bird and keeping with the family and not wanting to lose the family and not wanting to change as a person. So there were still those tensions all the way through. And I didn't, and she didn't know she'd complete. She was always at the edge of leaving. But yeah, it's not always doom and gloom, but I think even for students who do complete, they were always, and after, you know, even students who complete and do masters and do PhDs and get academic jobs, even if you talk to people like Valerie Rogstein or Helen Lucy or anyone from that sort of generation, still those tensions that exist, right, throughout academic life.
Okay. Any other questions?
Maybe just a comment. I mean,
nothing's changed, and I didn't. A lot of my PhD and a lot of my chapters now have been subsumed really by domestic violence, which is not what I set out to look at. But the night before I came, I was teaching an adult ed class doing a certificate in education, and it was their last night, and people were swapping numbers, and there was a man in the class, and he gave them, and the woman said, I can't take his number because when I go home, my partner will be looking on the phone, see if I've been talking to any men. What type of people are, I can't be late, I can't stay and have a drink because if I'm 5 minutes late, I'll wonder where I've been. That goes on all the time. Huge, huge barrier. Yeah, it's just like, I said, have you seen Educate Me? It's just the same. Yeah. These two mothers have done an access course at a local provider. So they've just both done access courses run attached to a local high school. So they've managed to complete the access, but it was, and the Caroline did 2 years then. She did 2 years of university and then dropped out. And Emma did 1 year of university and then dropped out. So yeah. The big step of getting into access was that they knew other people that had done it from their sort of social milieu. And they began to think, if they've done it, maybe I can do it. So they had support from friends who'd done it before. So they could ask them to look at homework and, you know, discuss things with them. And then because of where the access courses were situated, most students were like them. So they didn't feel out of place. They were with working class students. They all had children. When they went to higher education institutes, that's when the problems really started kicking in, because they felt out, like a fish out of water. They felt like they weren't support systems. They felt like their problems weren't real problems. If they wanted to get an extension, it didn't fit into the tick box. And I had horrendous cases, not in these, but I had one person who was a student who'd, it was domestic violence. She wanted an extension on an essay. She'd been badly beaten. And she went to ask for help, which is bad enough anyway, because you don't want to go and tell people about all your personal business. But she went to speak to someone, and they said, we can't do anything unless you bring in a police report, which you don't. Most working class communities and a lot of other communities do not report domestic violence. And she had no intention of leaving. She just wanted a bit more time to do her essay. But to build herself in to go and share that story, to be told, come back with a police report. And I had another case. She's not, I haven't captured a sample, but another case of a woman whose ex-partner broke in and raped her, who was also asked for the police report. And I think the response and the lists are designed for your 20-year-old students. There's not, the problems that these students have got aren't on the, they're not on the list, and staff aren't trained. So you might be seeing admin staff who are just trained on the list. And they might be seeing admin staff who are trained on the list who are younger than them, but who have got no children and can't emphasise even. So it's very difficult.
the presentation today, Still Aiming Higher. Before, it occurred to me, one of the great things about this conference is about a third of those attending are from outside the UK. But it did occur to me with some of the papers that sometimes we're using terminology that maybe isn't entirely clear. Now, I think maybe by now you've already asked the question, what's Aim High? Does anyone need me to just quickly say what Aim High was before we... I think we'll cover it off a bit anyway in the course of the presentation.
What Aim High is...
Sorry, I do beg your pardon, Jim. I stand corrected quite rightly. I have to say, one of the purposes of the exercise for us today is very much to celebrate what Aim High has achieved so far in its 8 years of existence. And I've been involved with Aim High since before it came into being and helped to set up the local partnership in Hampshire in the Isle of Wight. So what are we going to do in the paper? What we want to talk about, obviously we're saying Still Aiming Higher, so we are going to have a look to the future. We want to talk about the project as well and celebrate it in some respect. It's a very broad overview of the Aim High project. The focus is on the one that we know best, which is Aim Higher Hampshire in the Isle of Wight. But we do feel that many of the things that we're saying apply to other Aim High partnerships. And given that we've got people in here from other Aim High partnerships, I'm hoping, first of all, A, that we don't appear to be telling you how to suck eggs, because you'll have learned different lessons and achieved different things, but also that the conversation that we have afterwards can be informed by your own experiences as well, which would be great. So we don't want to generalise too much, but we do think there are some general lessons. And before I go to the next slide, can I thank Zita for her incredibly creative application in the use of PowerPoint, because all of the graphics and sounds that you are about to hear are a product of her fevered imagination. Always, always build in applause on the basis that you don't expect it from your audience. That's the kidding. Okay, so Still Aiming Higher. How can the lessons of Aim Higher inform and shape new strategic approaches to widening participation? And we might have added in brackets, in a very challenging environment, but that goes without saying, I think. Maybe that's a little bit of magic. That's a Mr. Ben sound effect, I'm sure it was. Still Aiming Higher. Okay, what worked? Well, first of all, certainly from our experience in Hampshire and the Isle of Wight, one thing that we really feel with regard to the widening participation agenda is that partnership really did work. And I say that in a very pragmatic way. You have to have the right conditions, you have to have a good strategic focus, and you have to have good coordination and leadership. And I think we were very fortunate in that we had all of those things. Now, again, I'm talking about partnership that developed over 8 years. And in many ways, looking back on the partnership and its formation, it's kind of followed the pattern that you get in normal group formation. So if anyone's familiar with the Tuckman description of how groups form, so groups form, then they storm, then they norm, then they perform. Seems to us, looking back on the history of Aim Higher, that's very much the pattern that it followed. We had a very stormy initial period where institutions that were not familiar with working with each other and in some cases were quite vicious competitors and still are in some contexts, but suddenly there was an agenda around which they could agree and put aside those differences. And I think that was partly a result of the agenda itself, which, because of course you're not working with students who would normally be looking to recruit immediately, but you're looking at working with children, you know, year 7, year 8, year 9, year 6, in fact, more recently in our case. But also because you're looking at a group that were very well led, in that I think that those issues were resolved out quite early on by being very open about it. And as I say, I was in at the very beginning, and Tony Ackland, who was the director of Aim Higher Hampshire in the Isle of Wight, was very adept at getting all of the parties around the table, getting everyone to put their cards on the table and talk that through. So when I say partnership works, I don't really want to paint a kind of motherhood and apple pie picture that suddenly we all went, ooh, let's work together and it was all fine. It clearly wasn't like that, as you'll appreciate. But what it was a growth process whereby I think probably by the third year, we were beginning to settle into a really good pattern of working. And from there, it developed very well indeed. And the results that we achieved there, I think, are testament to that. So the next bit, targeted funding gets results. This is probably the most depressing one in a way, isn't it? Without a doubt, the use of funds specifically targeted to raising aspirations in the groups that we were looking at was an absolute essential. Prior to Aim High's introduction, certainly all the universities in the partnership had widening participation strategies. In fact, they were required to. They had commitments to widening participation, but the level of activity, if you looked at it, really wasn't that great. And I can say, for example, in the case of our own institution, the numbers that we were engaging with were pretty small. The introduction of proper targeted funding with a strategically aligned programme allowed us to do a great deal more, and the numbers that we engaged with rocketed. And I think not just, I mean, obviously it isn't just a numbers game, there's more to it than that, but what we got there in terms of the quality and the quantity was a major, major step change. The other aspect of that, of course, as well, is that when I talk about partners, there's a tendency, certainly, to talk about just the HEIs. The key factor here was that we were also able to leverage cooperation through funding into colleges, funding through the local authority, and so on. Which leads me on to the third point, that diverse partnerships are stronger. Certainly in the case of our partnership, as it grew, it grew in size, and the number of partners that we had included there expanded considerably, and that was an enormous advantage. So we started really with just the four universities. It then expanded out to take in the logical next step, which was the colleges of further education and sixth form colleges, which we have a lot of in Hampshire. Then it sort of enfolded the local authorities and the schools, but then we started to bring in other agencies as well, connections at that point in time, and then later the education business partnerships. And in fact, you know, there are a number of others I could mention as well. But the idea being that those groups could work collectively. And there was that phrase which went round in kind of Blairite circles, joined up government and joined up thinking. There really was joined up thinking here. And the agencies involved really did work in that way. And I have to say that's one of the positive things that we won't lose when the funding goes. And I'll say more about that later. Continuity is key, and of course when we started out with Aim Higher, when it kicked off in 2003, there was no notion it might go beyond 3 years, given the nature of the university in which we live. In fact, the expectation was that, like most three-year funding streams, you just about start to get it right and they take your money off you. In this case, fortunately, we had a bit longer to work, and that continuity worked wonders. What it meant you could do, of course, crucially, and it's basic really, but it's often overlooked, particularly in terms of how funders operate, is that we were able to learn some valuable lessons in the first couple of years, learn what worked, learn more importantly perhaps what didn't work, and then adjust the programme appropriately. So that by the time you're hitting year four, year five, and so on, you're actually finding that your targeting is better, that the activity is more effective, the feedback that you've already received has made you shape the programme in a way that is far more beneficial to the people that you're dealing with. I've mentioned good coordination. I won't go too far about that. But certainly in our case, the way we operated was there was a central team based at the lead university, which is the University of Winchester. That central team became, in a sense, a broker between the various partners to ensure the various partners were engaged, to ensure that any minor conflicts or difficulties could be dealt with. And that was fundamentally important. And as things wore on, and we began to become more sophisticated in some of our monitoring and evaluation techniques, of course, we had a central team that was able to have the overview of all the activity that was going on across all of the partners. Very, very valuable. I've worked in partnership contexts a number of times in the past. I've never encountered one that was as effective as this one. Again, don't get me wrong, there were fallings out, there were problems along the way, there were changes of emphasis and so on, but nevertheless, the key thing here was that there was a clear steer and there was always a point of stability we could refer back to. So one of the things I would definitely say is that a strong partnership is key, and a strong partnership can deliver results. And I'm getting kind of frustrated at the moment because I think we're reaching that point where a lot of people are saying, partnership, what's that? isn't that kind of fluffy and fuzzy? Is that just your way of, you know, creating another set of meetings or being more bureaucratic? And I would say absolutely the reverse in this case. The nature of the partnership, well managed, well focused, well targeted, actually means you get better results, and that's certainly been our experience, and we'll expand upon that in a moment. But now I'll just hand over to my esteemed colleague Zita.
Text has gone wonky, I'm afraid.
Apologies, the text has gone a bit wonky. If I tell you a bit about myself, I'm head of planning at Southampton University. And when I say to people I'm involved with social mobility, social inclusion, and so on, and I think, well, do you work in planning? My boss is also the Deputy Vice Chancellor of Finance. Hates me as DVC, so he likes to see himself as Director of Finance and Resources. But my involvement goes back in the good old days, I suppose, when access and partnerships and all those good things were just beginning to become part of the political agenda. And for those of you who were in newcomers session, would have heard me talk about being in an inception phase. And the reason that I was in an inception phase is that as in those days I was called Deputy Registrar Planning. I signed up my organization, which was then called Southampton Institute, and therefore myself as members of FACE. And the reason is because our institution believes very much in social inclusion. And we've heard a lot of talk in the last day or two and even before about social mobility. And I've heard colleagues today trying to grapple with the definition of social mobility. And even in actually saying the word social mobility, we then talked about mobility, you know, being something that can move up and down. It doesn't necessarily mean social inclusion. It doesn't necessarily mean equality of opportunity. However, for those of you who may remember the white paper of the Blair government in 2003, where it was titled The Future of Higher Education, when a commitment was given by the Labour government to ensure that the former excellence that was achieved by things like the Excellence Challenge and Partnerships with Progression, and we used to call it P4P, would carry on, but it would carry on in such a way that it would be done in a national way, but structured around regional forums and sub-regional steering groups, and we were going to call it what? AIM Higher. And that was the birth of AIM Higher, 2003. In the last 8 years that we've had AIM Higher, one of the things about government, former government and the current government, when they came into being and started thinking about how they were going to reorganize higher education, was what do we get out of AIM Higher? What is it giving us? Well, the vision in that white paper was one of a coherent national outreach program, which would focus on giving and offering best value for the taxpayer, value for money. And it's one of the things that my boss, as the man who holds the purse strings for our institution, thinks about. So did AIM Higher provide the taxpayer with value for money? It's a question. It's a question on everybody's who's involved with finances and higher education. That's a question on their lips. Did it provide us with value for money? Well, Grant Thornton, in January of this year, in their report to Hefty, stated that overall the partnerships have sought, to varying degrees, to assess the impact arising from the funding that they have received, comparing target numbers with actual output, and so on. And they went on to say that although the methodology varied considerably, and it therefore was not possible for them to assess accurately whether the maximum value for money had been achieved, it could still be argued that there was value for money. Over our colleague Jimmy said, it's not quite over yet, but almost there. Over that period of time, although we can't and haven't been able to measure it in the way the current political forums would like us to measure it, we can actually argue that we have had value for money in the 8 years of the operation of Aim Higher. And how can we say that? Well, a recent study was done, and that study showed that young participants in higher education has significantly increased, at least in England, that we can talk about, because this research was done for England, to the point where over 20% of young people are more likely to continue into higher education than in the mid-1990s, with young people from disadvantaged areas substantially more likely to do so. So we come back to not social mobility, as it's been thrown around, but social inclusion as well, equality of opportunity. The proportion of young people living in the most disadvantaged areas who enter higher education has increased by 50% over the last 15 years, and over 30% in the last 5 years. This is what this study has shown. So, from 50% in over 15 years, and then 30% in 5 years, I think that's providing value for money to the taxpayer. It also said that the proportion of young people living in the most advantaged areas who enter higher education had increased at a slower rate than for disadvantaged young people, by over 15% over that 15-year period, and by more than 5% in the last 5 years. Again, if that isn't value for money, I don't know what is. So the success of Aim Higher is due in part to the length of time that the program was endorsed on. And this comes back to what Steve said about continuity. The length of time it was allowed to run allowed the program to show some outcome, not measurable in the way that politicians would like it to have been measured, but we can quite clearly see from the research that was done that we did get value from it. The other thing that it achieved was creating of partnerships where before there was competition. And, you know, that's in my institution as well. There was always this underlying competition with other nearby institutions that are similar to our own. Aim Higher has created partnerships, greater links with those institutions. So, what now? We're coming to the end of Aim Higher. What now? Well, there are two points of view on this. There's the, if you like, the pessimistic point of view, and I must say that lunchtime yesterday, I was with Steve and we were busy looking at the summary points of the published white paper.
Swearing?
yes, swearing. We both looked at each other and said, we're going back to Victorian times. This was later, very shortly after we had made the comment to each other, echoed by Professor Keat. And then again this morning, if we listen to our colleagues who did the roundtable, Margaret Cameron and Deirdre, they were both saying the same thing. We are moving backwards. If this policy is allowed to run in the way that most people are interpreting that it would be run. So what can we do as institutions, as members of society that want to have and ensure that we achieve better things for our young people, for the next generation? As Margaret said this morning, we are in danger of actually disadvantaging the next generation. Because whatever we do now, we are not going to benefit. Personally, it might keep a few of us in work for a bit longer, but at the end of the day, it's the next generation. They're the people. You know, my children, well, in my case, grandchildren, in Steve's case, his children, and so on, they're the people who are going to actually reap what we're sowing now. So, what has the government come up with to assist us to move things forward? Well, on the optimistic side, they have recognized the value of outreach as a mechanism to promote access to AG for the disadvantaged. And they've confirmed their commitment to promoting upward social mobility. We come back to this phrase again, social mobility. The support mechanism that they've set up is the National Scholarship Program, or as we would say, in the sector, the NSP, everybody bandages these acronyms around. And that's designed to complement, rather than replace, what the universities are already doing. Because we're not just going to suddenly stop what we're doing. We've got programs in place already that we've started, and we will continue to work with our partners, we continue to work with the local community, etc. So all the things that we're doing will in some way continue. We may have to scale it down because the finances isn't there. As someone also said in a session I was in this morning, but of course all of these things you're talking about cost money. Yes. But what's the alternative? It will actually cost us more in the longer term than it would cost us now to ensure that the young people are not disadvantaged, that we include our disenfranchised young people. And not only young people, but disenfranchised adults. As Margaret said ran to the round table this morning, she was disenfranchised. She wasn't disadvantaged, she was disenfranchised. So not only do we have to ensure that we actively re-engage the disenfranchised, but also the disadvantaged. And this is what I mean when I talk about social inclusion. So coming back to what the government is saying, through the NSP, they're going to give us some money. They are saying that if any institution charges more than 6,000 fee per annum from 2012, that we have to have an offer access agreement that agreed with offer that's accepted by FE, etc. And you know, we're one of those institutions that will be charging more than 6,000, and most institutions in the United Kingdom will be charging, well, I shouldn't say the United Kingdom because it only applies to England at the moment, will be charging more than 6,000. Although I saw that the authors are also thinking about charging in Scotland, it's going to be for those outside of Scotland, but it would still be British students who will be paying for their education. So what's the government going to actually put in terms of money? They say that they will contribute £50 million to this programme in 2012-13, raising it to £100 million in 2014, and then to £150 million from 2014 onwards. They claim that full-time students will receive a benefit of no less than £3,000, and this will be prorated if they're part-time students. Studying, for those students who are studying for a minimum of 25% intensity of a full-time equivalent. In most institutions, a full-time equivalent is 120 pounds. Now, I don't know what your institutions are planning to do, and Steve will tell you what we're going to do, and how we're going to use the money that we will get out of this 50 million originally that's been allocated. So, what strategic lessons then can we take forward in terms of funding and money? I think I just like to take this opportunity to say to my colleagues who have been part of the AIM Higher program that they should be really proud of the achievements that they have done in the last 8 years. I think it's something that they can pat themselves on the back and say, a job well done. Because there are key lessons also that will come out of the good practice that we've had from AIM Higher for us to take forward. Of course, the substantial funding cuts mean that in the public sector means that we will have to be more creative, more innovative in what we do and how we use the money that we will get in order to carry forward all the things that we'd like to do. And at this point, I'll pass you back to Steve.
Thank you. Conscious we're going on to the sales. Speed things through a little bit. Okay, so in terms of where we go next, just to sort of sum things up really, partnership working we see as key, targeted mechanisms we see as key, sustainable outreach programs we see as key. So I'm just going to tear through because we're a bit going on there. What I think is of greatest interest really is where we go next. So I'm just going to jump around a bit. So we did have some videos to show you. Ironically, we're in a cinema, but we can't get the technology to show a video to you. So in terms of the future, I'm just going to bounce things around a little bit and put you off, Zita. But in terms of where we go next, I think we've established partnership as key. The good news, I think, for us, and I'm talking to a lot of people around the country now who work in partnerships, and the story's different wherever you talk to. Where we are certainly, I think there is still a sense, there's an acceptance that AIM Higher has achieved its objectives. I think there's an acceptance that partnership, when it's properly focused and targeted in the way that I've already outlined, does the job. So the good news there, I think, is that certainly with the universities at the moment being driven towards a more competitive bent, there is still an appetite for partnership around the access agenda. And I think that's useful. And of course, those of you who may have dealt with the construction of access agreements to offer, there was within that some encouragement for universities to demonstrate a partnership approach. And there were specific references, in fact, to AIM Higher and how universities would continue the AIM Higher mission. Now, the skeptic in me feels that you know, some of that's tokenistic. However, I do feel that there's an opportunity there. And certainly the partners in Hampshire, having experienced a partnership that works and that delivers the goods, all agreed we must make sure our offer access agreements reflect the value of partnership. And that's what's happened. Making the most of offer. Leaving aside the various reservations one might have about offer and about the way in which access agreements are being operated and where that might go, we do have an opportunity here to keep the agenda alive. And we have to grab that very, very firmly, and make the most of it. One of the things that's interesting, of course, is at the moment we're seeing an assault on the public sector on just about every front. One of the things I think is important, and certainly the thing that we've done in our context, is to actually look at ways in which we can not just continue the partnership working that we've been undertaking through AIM Higher, but actually ways in which we can develop some new forms of partnership working that deal with the current circumstances. And certainly in Southampton, one of the things that's happened there, in my role, I'm a member of the 14 to 19 Consortium Board. Well, of course, the consortium is a very interesting beast that was created really to promote the development of the diploma. It still exists in Southampton. And in fact, interestingly, I attended their conference last week. And the feeling at the moment is that the 14 to 19 consortium, made up as it is of head teachers of secondary schools, college principals and representatives of HE, will become a very important body in terms of driving the education agenda in our region. Because what we're seeing at the same time is a withdrawal by the local authority, partly driven by legislation and policy that's pushing schools in a different direction, so more academies, more direct relationships with the Department for Education and so on. Also partly because I think our local authority has for a number of years been deliberately removing itself from that whole area. So the interesting thing here is that whilst we're in this incredibly threatening environment, there are some new opportunities. And the great thing about the conference I attended last week was that actually at the end of that conference, the schools, colleges and universities in Southampton, and I'm just talking about Southampton at the moment, have agreed a whole range of actions, in addition to what the universities have had to put in for their offer agreements, around the aspiration-raising agenda, and in fact, even managed to secure, believe it or not, some funding from the local authority to support the continuation of that work. Now, I think that, you know, in some ways, it's anecdotal, but for me, there's a real sense in which the value of AIM Higher has been affirmed there, that you have a local authority in these straitened times willing to actually put some money into continuing this kind of work. So the message, certainly in terms of our experience, has been the partnership can work, partnership does work. I think the offer access agreement at the moment, at least the way in which things are structured, offers real opportunities. But what I would encourage, and I think this relates back to a lot of the conversations that we've heard so far today, and a lot of the comments that have been made, is that we are in a period of great change and great flux. But actually there are people out there facing different challenges, but actually you can come together to forge a common path. And I think that's where we're going with AIM Higher. So when we say still aiming higher, we mean that quite literally, because the work that AIM Higher has done has been of enormous value. The partners, and not just the partners, but other people in the region recognise the value of that, and they're putting their money where their mouth is. So that's a really positive story. And I have to say, I've been in touch with a number of other people in other parts of the country. What I would urge is look to see where you can work with people perhaps you didn't before. And the let's stick together message isn't just let's stick together those of us that worked previously, but actually, are there new alliances that you can forge? Are there new things that you can do there? It's a very, very difficult environment, and that may sound like a slightly over-optimistic message. But I think in the face of what we're having to deal with, you have to keep your head up, and that's what we're trying to do. Did you want to say something about monitoring and evaluation there? Sorry to switch the ordering around, but yeah.
I mentioned earlier that in wanting to find out whether we get value for money in the money that we spend on things like access, like social mobility, like widening participation, all those good things, monitoring is going to be the key. As we go forward, offer, we know, has been given increased powers, as we, for those of you who've seen the white paper, they've got increased powers. They can come in and monitor what the students are doing and evaluate whether we are actually offering value for money. And they can come in at a moment's notice if the white paper and the interpretation of it is to be believed. So, monitoring and evaluation is going to be key as we move forward. As Steve said, working in partnerships. But we have always, in my experience, certainly in my own institution, we've taken quality for granted because we believe what we provide is of good quality. So we've taken it for granted. Unfortunately, we're moving into this new, brave, challenging world. We can no longer just take it for granted. We're going to have to prove it again and again and again, all the time. Students are going to start considering themselves consumers and not students. And consumers behave differently to students. Therefore, we're going to have far more pressures on our resources. And if we have more pressures on the resources, we're going to have to actually, again, monitor that very closely. So, if I want to laboring the point, I just want to say that for those of you who are going out back out there to carry on the good work that you have been doing all this time, or starting new things, new projects, etc., please remember that
in this new world of moving forward, the monitoring and evaluation is going to be key. And it's one of the things that Steve and I have already started looking at in our own institution, how are we going to do that? And not only how are we going to do it, but actually finding out who's going to be doing it in our organisation, so that as we move forward with all these various things, we can actually have a clear operational structure in place to do our monitoring and evaluation.